This is a CKT Core presentation.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is there is this thing? Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are one day into the month of April. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Sasha. On today's show, an interview with Anne Borden from Autistics for Autistics Ontario, and John Lepke, speaking about the COVID-19 crisis and its impact on the disability community. All that and more, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. First up this hour, an interview with Anne Borden from Autistics for Autistics Ontario and their plain language guide regarding the COVID-19 crisis. That's up now.
Hi, welcome to the show. I'm here with Anne from Autistics for Autistics Ontario. And would you be able to describe the history of your organization and your work with it?
Yes, it's great to be here too. Thanks for inviting me. Our organization was founded in November of 2017, and it was co-founded, I'm one of the co-founders, as a way for autistic people to be able to speak for ourselves. So it's an autistic self-advocacy organization. We do work in community education, political advocacy, and community support and community building.
And you recently wrote a plain language guide on COVID-19. Would you mind describing the contents of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have it right in front of me. We came up with this idea, a couple of us in the group, to get something out there about COVID-19 that's in plain language, meaning that more people can understand it. It's not full of a lot of technical jargon. And also specifically for autistic people, talking about some of the things that we would specifically be concerned about. So it starts out with talking about what COVID-19 is, explains why we're sheltering in place or staying at home as we are here in Ontario. And then it gives some resources for people who use AAC, which is alternative communication devices, people who are non-speaking, gives some resources for people who are non-speaking for navigating the medical system and what's going on and having access to communication. And then it talks a little bit about kind of coping and how to connect with people, how to cope with what's going on, with a little bit of advice as well for caregivers if someone is living with a caregiver. And then a brief discussion about what might happen next, because that was a really big question that a lot of people have.
Could you describe why plain language is necessary
in communications for COVID-19 and others?
It's really, really important, and we don't see very much of it. I'm really surprised with COVID how little communication is coming out of the medical field that can be understood by the average person. A lot of it's really technical, and you start looking at all these big words and long paragraphs, and it feels very overwhelming, and it's hard to understand. So it's really, really important, especially in the case of something where it's about health and safety, to make sure that it's plain language. The challenge with plain language is that sometimes plain language guides, if they're not written by actually disabled people, they can come across as kind of patronizing, right? And kind of like talking down to the person. So the best people to write plain language guides are people who are autistic, have Down syndrome, a variety of intellectual disabilities, really driving these projects, writing these projects, or at the very least, very heavily consulting and very heavily involved with these kind of guides so that they really speak to people in a way that is comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any other plain language guides that have been circulating? And how does yours differ from those that have already been created?
Yeah, there are some good ones. I will say Harvard did plain language, but then they kind of messed it up because they had it like by age group, like for 5 to 7-year-olds, like that doesn't really work. You know, cognition isn't kind of broken down like grades in school. However, Brandeis did a really nice one, and that could be read by people of any age, Brandeis University. Another great one was written by the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, and that was actually written by people who are disabled, have intellectual or developmental disability. So that was written in a really, really accessible way. Mm-hmm. And then there's Our Guide, and these are the major ones. There are also some good guides by AAC makers. Cough Drop, I think, has a guide. And there's another guide by Assistive Wear. Assistive Wear has been doing a lot of good guides and information for people who are using AAC to communicate.
And do you believe that the methods that the government has used thus far to communicate vital information regarding COVID-19 has been sufficient?
I think they could do a better job with plain language, especially by consulting with people who understand plain language and know how to write using plain language and benefit from plain language. I think for sure they could be doing a better job.
So governmental briefings on coronavirus only recently began offering accessibility measures, for example, sign language interpretation, the week of March 16th. Why do you think the implementation of methods of communication such as this were considered later in comparison to quote unquote traditional communication?
I think it's that way so much of the time that disabled people are an afterthought. And I don't know why, I mean, especially federally, because they've made this big statement about how they're going to start, what's the expression that they use, like including disability in everything they do, like right from the start. So it was actually, I was surprised at how long it took them because I knew that they had this new commitment, but I haven't really seen a lot of legs to that commitment, and that was really disappointing. And I think there still is more work to be done to reach various disabled communities in the way they communicate.
The Accessible Canada Act, in its current status,
primarily refers to federal physical, like governmental bodies. So, for example, government buildings. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that language should have been included in the creation of this act?
It really, really should have. And like any disability accommodation, it would benefit everyone, not just disabled people, if they had included language in that. The legislation also really didn't have anything for autistic people, and there was no consultation done with autistic people for that legislation. So there are a number of things missing there.
Are there methods of communication that the government hasn't yet implemented that would be able to better assist disabled people?
I think so. I think that they need to communicate more directly with disability self-advocacy groups and disability self-advocates and ask, mm-hmm. what are different communities and individuals need, and then respond to that need. I don't think having a bunch of quote-unquote experts who are non-disabled trying to just kind of do guesswork on the fly in the background as an afterthought is going to be a good way to do it. We'd like to see the government really reaching out directly to groups like ours and asking us what's missing and what we need. And we can provide it. I mean, it's very simple for us to do that rather than having them kind of doing guesswork.
And do you feel that the accessibility measures regarding language have been adequately communicated by caregivers to the populations that require them? For example, in the blog post, you mentioned that there are soundboards specific to COVID-19. Is this a feature that's widely known to caregivers as a resource?
I mean, I think the companies that make these boards are trying to get the information out there, but I don't think that it's entirely successful. I think if someone, it all depends on the quality of who's caring for the person and where the person lives. If they're living in a residential program where the people are really not putting effort into knowing what's new and knowing what's going on and querying these things, I don't think they're going to find them. You know, you would really need mm-hmm. something. This is all happening kind of ad hoc by private groups like ours. In the case of AAC, it might be a company that's making AAC, but if you don't use that brand, you might never hear about it. Ideally, you would have kind of a master post, a master list that the government had of accessibility resources, and then they would distribute these resources to all of the residential programs and all of the schools in terms of how they're doing education, the way that they're doing education now. And they would have a way to get it to parents as well through various agencies, but that's not happening.
And why do you feel it isn't happening?
I don't think they have had a plan. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating at this point, but it doesn't look like they had thought about these various moving pieces when they were getting ready for something like a pandemic. So they need to reach out and ask people in the disability community, and I mean really disabled people. In the case of autistic people, there is a whole bunch of non-autistic people who claim to speak for us, groups like CASDA and some of these other Autism Speaks. If the government's going and asking them, they're going to the wrong people. Those people are not disabled, and they don't know what it's like to be autistic, and they don't know what autistic people need. They need to reach out directly to self-advocates to understand what's needed.
How does the level of like recommendations vary when provided by someone such as like a representative from Autism Speaks who necessarily doesn't have autism versus directly from a person with autism?
Well, we're asking everyone in the broader disability community not to partner with or work with organizations like Autism Speaks or CASDA in particular, because they are, first of all, in the case of Autism Speaks, there's the broader issue of the genetic research and some of the eugenics that they support. But aside from that, they also really follow what's known as the medical model of disability, where the disabled person is the problem and you fix the child to make them fit in a world that isn't built for them. The social model of disability tells us, why don't we make some changes to the world around us so that it can fit us. And it's just, it's the same for autism as it is for any disability, right? And I think that these big groups that kind of speak, they tend to speak as though we're broken puzzle pieces that need to be fixed, and what kind of therapies and things can we get so that we're not so weird and whatever, like, is really damaging to autistic people in many, many ways. And it doesn't make for successful outcomes either. If the government and policymakers are looking for successful outcomes, the only way you're going to have that is if we look at autism from the social model of disability and start making changes to the environment. And the only people that can really communicate what changes are needed, whether it's in school, whether it's in healthcare, or anywhere else, the only people who are really going to be able to articulate what's needed is actually autistic people. Like, for example, we go, Autistics for Autistics, our group, goes to the University of Toronto Medical School a couple of times a year, and we give a talk about to med students, how can you make your practice accessible for people who use AAC, for people with sensory issues, for people with communication differences, all of the types of challenges that we know that we have faced when we have tried to seek healthcare. We know what the barriers are that we face, and we know that there are some really simple solutions. And when we go in and speak to the med students about how they can make their practice more accessible, they're very receptive, they're very open. It's really a simple matter of teaching them some really simple accessibility measures that will have an impact on hundreds of people throughout their career. But we're the only ones doing it. It's the autistic people that are doing it. When you have an autism organization like Autism Speaks or someone coming in, they're much more likely to talk about how to identify autism or kind of make us seem like we're like sort of a germ in a petri dish rather than, hey, we're people. And it would really help if you learned a little bit about this. It would really help if you could allow your patients to email if they are not able to use the phone, things like that. And that all comes from the grassroots, the disability rights community, not from these big organizations who claim to speak for us.
And have these organizations, for example, spoken or released anything in regards to COVID-19? And what are your thoughts on those?
I've been looking. Now, I haven't seen anything from Autism Speaks. I kind of don't like looking at what they do. Yeah. Because of the eugenics, et cetera. But I have seen some organizations that have put out guides. Generally, they're putting out like a guide for caregivers. And then it'll be this like massive long document of like how to talk to your child about COVID. So already they've taken the subjectivity away from the actually autistic person. They're not addressing autistic people, they're addressing their carers, and that just symbolic of how they tend to do things. And I just saw one today, I couldn't believe it, someone sent it to me, I can't remember who put it out, it was a Canadian group from the West, and they did this whole big thing, this whole big website, they probably had grant money for it, and they never once mentioned non-speaking, nonverbal autistic people. They had it all set up for autistic people who could speak, but we know that like 30% of autistic people are either non-speaking or partially speaking. It's quite incredible that a big agency like that would just render all those people invisible in their document.
And how has the community in Ontario been impacted by the crisis?
I think it's been impacted depending on where you live and who you are. So for some people who are living on their own or with roommates out on their own, they are facing, in many, many cases, because poverty is a big problem in our community, facing a lot of economic insecurity and a lot of worry about what might happen to their job, a lot of worry about what's going to happen with Ontario Works or ODSP or some of the programs that people are receiving. So there is anxiety and uncertainty and fear around the economic part of it. Then there's the social isolation, which everyone has to deal with, but which feels a little bit different, maybe for an autistic person than it would for a neurotypical person. I don't want to generalize to all autistic people. I think there are some stereotypes out there that we all just want to sit home and pet our cat, and we don't really care that we have to stay home, and we're all introverts, and that's not really true. Like, a lot of autistic people are really extroverted, and I think anyone, whether you're autistic or not, is missing the community, missing the routine. But I think from a sensory perspective, it can be more difficult being inside than it might be for someone else. It can be particularly difficult for people who are living in a group home setting or in a family setting where they're not happy and not comfortable, or that's not welcoming for them. I really, really worry about people in those kind of situations where there may have been an opportunity to get out for work and get out for school, and now they're home. So there's that as well. And then there's the sense of not knowing what's coming, which is something that impacts everyone. But it can be especially frustrating and can really start to lead you down a path of reading and learning and understanding and getting super duper into understanding COVID to the point where it's like, oh, you know, okay, I've learned everything possible about COVID now. I need to find ways to decompress. I need to find ways to connect with other people. So I guess to summarize, there's economic concerns. There are stress concerns of depending on people's living situations. And then there are our sensory and coping concerns that do look and feel different than they do for a lot of neurotypical people.
And how is the government of Ontario dealing with this crisis?
I'm just giving my opinion as an individual. I was really surprised. I watched Ford yesterday giving a press conference, and he was kind of being baited by the right-wing media to make negative comments about Trudeau and by a certain reporter, and he deflected it and he praised Trudeau. And I was really happy to see that. Like, it does seem like the government is taking its direction from public health experts, whether they're federal or whether they're provincial. So that was really comforting for me. The fallout once this is all over, I don't know. Like, I don't really know economically and socially what kind of impact it's going to have on our community, because so many in our community are already living in very low income and living on ODSP. That conversation isn't really happening right now, so it's really hard to tell, because it is a Tory government, what that's really going to be like in the future in terms of funding and aid.
And what are your opinions on the fact that the majority of disability support plans across Canada are below the poverty line, but with the bill that has been proposed, individuals would be receiving almost twice as much, for example, as recipients of ODSP. How do you feel that proposal impacts the level that we've set for essentially putting disabled people in poverty for no reason?
Well, it certainly points out the existing system, that the way that it isn't fair and the way that people are constantly living on the poverty line, and people who want to work a little bit get penalized for that. People who want to live with their partner or get married obviously are penalized right now under that system. This, for us as activists, it's an opportunity for us to raise awareness and say, well, compare the aid that's being provided by the government to what we're getting. It's a good opportunity to make people aware of the discrepancies and the second-class citizenship that comes from those discrepancies.
How can non-disabled people be allies to disabled people during this pandemic?
I think non-disabled people can be allies for disabled people by giving us a place at the podium. I think it's really, really important in any kind of project that has to do with COVID at all, that disabled people are right there, front and center, because we're in a place right now where we have space in Ontario for everyone in the hospital. But as we know, down in the US, they're rationing care. And as we know, sometimes the rationing programs exclude people that are disabled and are discriminatory towards people that are disabled. And there's a lot of worry and concern in Canada that that could happen here, depending on the direction that things go with healthcare and this virus. So some guarantees and some real commitment to making sure that disabled people are not left out in those kind of scenarios, and that evaluation of our life and an affirmation that our lives have values, have value, is really, really important. And visibility for autistic people and all disabled people, as much visibility as possible as well, is really, really important right now. My concern is that disabled people will not be given life-saving medical care in the event that there is rationing, and that it could be built into the triage policies at hospitals. And I think what everyone would like to see now is a really ironclad guarantee of that. And as well, just in general, positivity about disabled people coming from our government as a way to reassure people that it's not going to happen here the way that it has been happening in the U.S.
If listeners wanted more information on your organization, what should they do?
Oh, yes. So we're on Twitter. Our Twitter is at A4A Ontario. So A number 4A Ontario. And we're also on Facebook, A4A public page, it's called. We also have a website, which is a4aontario.com. And that's where you can find the plain language COVID guide with pictures. And we're also going to have more plain language COVID guides, as well as kind of survival guides for dealing with sheltering in place, and lots of other resources that we're putting together, including a master list of AAC resources. So definitely check it out. So many things that we had going are kind of on hold. We just heard today, and it wasn't a big surprise, but we heard that our neurodiversity flag raising at Toronto City Hall that was supposed to happen on April 6th, of course, has been canceled. So on April 6th, we're kind of taking a page from Fridays for Future, and we're going to make our neurodiversity pride raising, our neurodiversity flag raising, go online and do kind of a virtual one. And then we're also doing some work with Arch Disability Law Center on a number of projects. And we have our outreach program for medical school education. We have an employment education project going on. And you can read more about our projects if you go onto our blog and look at our quarterly reports to kind of see ongoing projects. The last project I want to mention is our Little Neurodiversity Free Library, which is a library of books about neurodiversity that is going to be housed at the Center for Independent Living Toronto. Mm-hmm. And then it will travel from the Center for Independent Living Toronto around to different libraries, different community centers, and different places throughout the province, so that people can check out these books and learn more about neurodiversity.
Okay. Thank you, Anne.
Great. It was great talking to you. Thanks.
You are just listening to Colder and Closer by Tops. Up next, an interview with John Lepke on the COVID-19 crisis and his recent piece on CBC News regarding the impacts of the pandemic for the disabled community in Saskatchewan.
Welcome to the show. Would you mind introducing yourself and your work to the audience?
Sure. So my name is John Lepke. For a couple more months, I am the editor-in-chief of the University of Regina student newspaper, The Carillon. I'm also a disabled artist and freelance writer and editor.
You recently published an article with the CBC on disability during the COVID-19 pandemic. How has your life been impacted since the measures taken by governmental bodies to promote social distancing?
Like I wrote in the article, not a lot has changed. On paper, right, like I'm a disabled artist, I often sit in the spec and bedroom of my apartment and work for 8 to 10 hours a day and then eat food and go to bed. What has changed is that I don't have the option to go outside. There's sort of a fear in our community, my community, in terms of disability, as fraught as the word community can be sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like when you're looking at these medical advisories from places like the Center for Disease Control in the States, and they might as well just say, like, disabled people stay home. You know, that's the unnerving part. I mean, I don't have any, like, my disability is on the list of reasons to isolate. I'm not the most at risk. It's mostly discussing that risk with other people I know. Mostly, to be honest, from my time in disability art and disability support. And you know, our whole community is scared. So that's, my coffee breaks used to be watching meaningless YouTube, and now my coffee breaks are checking in with friends and making sure that their health is okay.
What have the discussions been surrounding COVID-19 in your communities? What's the fear you're describing?
I think for some, it's the fact that, you know, here, if you're on, and full disclosure, I'm not, but if you're on Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disability, you know, you can only have $1,500 liquid in your bank account at once. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't leave a lot of room for, you know, we're seeing income supports for what should I call it, the general public that are higher than that. And our society is forgetting that disabled people are living off of far less while having to do far more to mm-hmm. stay alive and safe. I think my community is worried about, we see ourselves sort of tacked on to the elderly and, oh, by the way, the disabled. I don't think that there's an acknowledgement, I mean, like there rarely is, right, of disabled bodies as legitimate and healthy and to be lived in. it's a state for many able-bodied to be disabled is to be less than according to the able-bodied norm. And that is just, it's unfortunately when an event that causes self-isolation to the scale that we've got now should be building bridges between communities. We're seeing more and more divide, more and more think pieces in media about, look at what's been taken away from me after 4 days in isolation. And disabled people in my community being like, well, what about us that have, you know, been isolated for years?
In your piece, you speak about accommodations that were granted to the general public due to this crisis that were previously denied to disabled people. Can you provide some examples of this?
We're seeing a lot more online arts events, which I think are a wonderful positive. But this is proving again that when disabled people have asked for that or remote working and organizations have said it's too expensive or it's too hard to set up, and magically within a week we have universities finding ways to do it. Not that that's an easy transition, but suddenly when it becomes a requirement for the able-bodied or the neurotypical, it becomes unquestioned and something we need to do. But when it becomes something that disabled people need to survive, you know, like the rest of the time, you know, it's backburnered and, oh, you're asking too much, or you're, quote, bitter cripple in the corner. Oh, you just want everything. And that's, you know, that's not what our community wants. Lays further bare how accommodations are oftentimes those who are making the adaptions think it's a question of want, and those that are asking for them recognize it as a question of need. right? Mm-hmm. And now that that has become a need for people outside of the disabled community, suddenly it's not questioned anymore. Now, arts performances, you know, I think this is a great opportunity as a disabled artist to point out how ubiquitous these movements and these online events have become in such a short time, and mm-hmm. proving that these things can happen more. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes in arts circles, not to generalize the entire arts community, but I think sometimes in spaces in the arts in Canada tend to trend more left, tend to trend more inclusive, or think they're being inclusive. Well, they don't know what they don't know. I mean, that's a societal problem overall. And I think that this pandemic and this proving of seeing online concerts and, you know, poetry slams and suddenly film viewings are instantly online. I mean, a local arts festival is going completely online for the first time in their history coming up in May. You know, if anything, I hope this proves that that can exist alongside the live performance for those of us who can't always make it out to whatever that live thing is.
And in the example of food delivery services, you speak about a service that you frequently use is now being overloaded. Yeah. Do you believe that services such as this should have formal policies in place to prioritize at-risk populations during this pandemic?
I think one of the challenges is that lots of, and it comes to the, should we call it the education of disabled people? Like there's no manual for being disabled, obviously. But, you know, I talk to lots of people in my community who don't even realize that, because food delivery here is a relatively new, it's a relatively new phenomenon, sort of the last 2 or 3 years. And so it's as much about making people aware of what's there and the supports of what's there, whether that's food, whether that's health, whether that's communication, you know, online delivery, whatever it is. But I think we've seen hours in stores across Canada. You know, seniors and disabled people can come from 6 to 7 in the morning. All right, that's a movement forward, I suppose. But also, what elderly senior or disabled person who is at risk is going to be at that store at 6 to 7 o'clock in the morning? You know? Mm-hmm. And some people have suggested, like, there's an aisle of the store that's close, that all of the essentials are piled into, so that that's easier. We see lots of discussions in the States about certain days and here as well, where, you know, child tax credit and benefits are coming out. So, you know, leave the stores for people who need food stamps in the States and things like that. I think it requires some forethought, but as usual, the disabled people are last to be thought about. A big email went out saying, please leave this service for those who need it most. It's impossible for us to police this, nor can we or should we. You know, leave it for the most marginalized. How you formalize that is probably problematic at some point. That gets into sort of the, are you disabled enough for this service? But it does bear asking, how can those delivery services be more equitable? Does it mean that that delivery, you end up on a phone conversation with the person so that you don't get left in a situation where everything you ordered isn't actually there, so they can't deliver it to you? You know, there's all kinds of ways that we can adapt. It's just, we have to be thinking accessibility first, and been dealing with hundreds of years of not.
And what are some other similar services that have been impacted by an overload of new customers due to, for example, able-bodied people being self-isolated?
Food is the main one that I interact with. Yeah. I mean, usually the things that get overloaded, I don't know about Montreal, but here the things that usually get overloaded are things like paratransit services, which obviously aren't getting overloaded because you're not supposed to go outside. Mm-hmm. So I imagine, although I can't confirm, that things like Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disabled, just like EI is getting overloaded by phone calls and all of these government programs. I do find it interesting that suddenly when the largely white, largely privileged, keeping in mind that I fall into both of those categories, but when everybody is down on their luck, whatever saying we want to use, suddenly being on government programs is a matter of necessity as opposed to, scrounging or sponging or whatever insults we lay at the feet of marginalized people when they need to access those services. That 3-week switch from, being on the dole is bad to being on the dole is needed is an interesting thing to watch from a societal perspective and from a marginalized perspective. I think in a lot of ways, at least in Saskatchewan, I live independently in my own apartment with two dogs and my wife. But I think a lot of disability supports in this province are set up in assisted living or group home settings.
There's a lot of narrative switching, one of the general populace being on benefits. But when you look at the monetary amount as well, I'm not sure how much it is in Saskatchewan, but for Ontario, ODSP is around just under $800 a month, which is not livable at all in Ontario. But able-bodied people under the government benefits program set up as a result of COVID-19 are getting almost twice as much that. And even then, people are saying that it's also not a livable amount. Yeah. So for decades and decades to force disabled people to live in poverty, and then all of a sudden, as soon as the general populace is affected, to say, okay, we do actually have this money, sorry, is like irreprehensible.
I mean, it's interesting to look at the various programs. I mean, you would have to fact check this before quoting me on it, but I think BC is looking to up theirs. Meanwhile, like, I'm not on the program, but an article that we just printed for my student newspaper actually puts the average at about about the same as Ontario, except our limitations are, the biggest limitation that SED puts forward is the liquid assets you can have, where Ontario ODSP goes on the model of how much assets do you have in total, plus the, I think the limit is like 7,500 or something. That's just coming from former teammates, like I said. I think there's this radical disconnect, exactly right, everywhere, of like what is actually needed to live and what is expected. I mean, Saskatchewan's problem also is that we run a lot of the times on a charity model. So things like Telemiracle, which is run by the Kinsman Foundation, which is a yearly telethon that raises millions for disabled equipment that you then go and apply for. These are things that mean that the government system doesn't always see its job as supporting disabled people in the way that some other provinces have. And that suddenly becomes, you know, it's sort of the GoFundMe model of healthcare before the GoFundMe model of healthcare, which is incredibly frustrating to watch. There's a lack of autonomy afforded to a disabled person who is perpetually in poverty. And as we know about any government program that gives you money in any sense, I had a friend who said being poor is a full-time job, and it's true. To stay eligible. I mean, I imagine when those payments start going out, what, April 6th? We're going to see people going, how bleeping ridiculous it is that we have to check in every 2 weeks to maintain that we're still eligible. And all the disabled people are going to be like, uh-huh. Like, up until like 10 years ago, I had to send a letter every 5 years to the Canadian government proving that I was still disabled, as if my brain damage had worn off or something. Right? Like, this is not new to disabled folks.
So in your piece, you say, who better to take notes from on the intricacies of food prep on limited energy, whether that be from cerebral palsy or the impending sense of doom that comes with weeks inside your house, than a disabled person who has lived it for 20 years? How might a disability lens, when evaluating the pandemic, impact people's lives?
I think disabled people are uniquely positioned, some of us, I mean, it's not a broad brush, right? To speak about what isolation means. Like, I am not what some people would say homebound, right? I would call myself home restricted in the winter. If we're talking about spoon theory, the academic theory that, you know, how many spoons do you have for the day? Those go way down in the winter because my body does not like minus 40 and Mother Nature in Saskatchewan does. When you're struggling, whether that's because of you've lost your job, you're stuck at home, you've never dealt with anything like this before, you're cut away from your social structure, these are things that some disabled people are used to. Doesn't mean we're having a great time of it, but I think things like food prep, lots of things around the plastic ban, ooh, plastic and pre-washed food. I think suddenly we're going to see some people that are buying a heck of a lot of pre-packaged food, and that's good. I mean, if that means that you have more energy at the end of the day, and you can source that food from whatever feels sustainable or equitable to you, I think suddenly discussions of how to create a social network for yourself in isolation. We're seeing people basically having Zoom drinking parties and things like that. I think these discussions of how do you connect when there's a barrier? For some of us, that's getting out of bed or getting out of the house. And right now, that is sort of the limitation that's being put on those outside of the traditional disabled community. We're going to see a mental health crisis. People, humans are social creatures. There's also, without the supports that we need, without the conversations that we need to have, that depression and the negative health outcomes, that, shall we say, that come from prolonged social isolation are going to start popping up. And I think that requires some humility on the behalf of some people that don't, the few that are coming to the grips with the fact that we make up 25% of the population eventually, like on a macro scale. I think some people are coming to the grips with the fact that a heck of a lot of people in our country are used to exactly this. And they're watching the able-bodied reaction and going, I really don't need a top 10 list of the things you've lost because you've been in social isolation for 4 days.
And what about other aspects of the pandemic? How are other ways that, like, facts that disabled people have known for their entire existence, how are they now able to navigate that better than, for example, someone that had never been able to deal with it before?
Disabled people know that government is slow. Disabled people know the tricks. For example, in Saskatchewan, if you need to get a hold of the government, go down the French line because they never have anybody call and they will switch you back to the English line. That's a tiny thing, not uniquely disabled, I guess. But it's suddenly knowing how to set up a social network or what might work better or quote-unquote productivity tips or how to modify. I mean, what is disabled life without adaption, right? Like, realistically. So what's even our thought process to adaption? I mean, we all have it differently, but, you know, I came from a school of physiotherapy that was very like, think through the adaption you need. Oh, I need to lean over there to get up this curve, that kind of thing. And that's a model in whatever way that is, whether that's sort of a care model, care network model, whether that's a sort of overly intellectual model of adapting to circumstances that able-bodied or neurotypical people are facing now. So we're uniquely positioned to adapt, and that means that we might be a good sounding board for those who are wondering how the hell they're supposed to adapt.
So though the World Health Organization lists people with various disabilities as risk populations, do you feel that governments around the world have taken adequate measures in order to prioritize disabled lives?
I mean, we're seeing in the States that a number of states have said that people with intellectual disabilities are at the back of the line for care in the southern U.S. Disabled people are often seen as second-class citizens. Let's just put it straight out there, you know, or we're either seen as like the pity, oh, isn't it so sad that you're in a wheelchair and blah, blah, blah. Or you're the super crip. Aren't you amazing for getting out of bed in the morning? And the pandemic means that we're seen as a liability oftentimes. And that is just proving itself out again. Well, if they're disabled, they're halfway to the grave. Why would we give a shit about using a ventilator on them? We've got a limited supply. Why not choose the healthy one? And that's just a typical ableist approach to healthcare. You know, we want to pretend that we give good healthcare to disabled people, but so many disabled supports across Canada stop as soon as you turn 18. Like, they think that you stop having cerebral palsy or don't, but you know, they don't always care, right? It's like, it doesn't affect you as much once you're 18, or, you know, the radical lack of support for autistic people after the age of 18. There's no concept of what, I grew up in Britain and they used to call it cradle to grave care. There's no concept right now that disabled bodies are worth, it's seen in a capitalist sense as not worth investing all of that money that we rightfully deserve to stay alive in order to be members of society. I mean, when we talk about disabled people being a functioning member of society or a contributing member of society, What our bogus, ableist, capitalist society is saying is you're only worthy if you have a job. And this pandemic is proving that actually disabled knowledge and disabled disability culture, disability art, disability sport shouldn't be viewed from that capitalist lens. And, you know, we want to say that we have free healthcare in this country, but we don't have PharmaCare in all of the provinces for disabled people. Being disabled is expensive. I mean, we need to, as much as I would love to believe those that are saying this is our time to reshape society, I'm like, yes, and also try to stay alive. Like, mm-hmm. Priority one, stay alive. Priority two, the revolution starts at dawn, and bring your wheeling gloves. Like, I don't know what else is.
In the U.S., individual states have the ability to restrict medical care based on their own criteria. For example, in Alabama, Governor Kay Ivey recently signed a bill that would systemically restrict those with intellectual disabilities diagnosed with coronavirus from accessing ventilators. Do you feel similar eugenics-like measures may take place within Canada?
I think it will be less formalized than that, but I think that the inherent ableism of the medical system will show its face, yes. In the sense that I think there will come a position, sad to say, where a doctor has to choose between giving a disabled person a ventilator and an able-bodied person, and I'm not naive enough to believe that they will not choose the able-bodied person. I also think that government supports of those in group homes or assisted living places where sometimes the more medical model terminology alert severely disabled are congregated in our society. We want to pretend that disabled people aren't segregated, but we are. Even at the sort of best, most open society, you know, disabled people tend to live in certain areas of the city because those are the only areas that are accessible. I doubt you see too many wheelchair users in Old Montreal. I mean, imagine if I looked at the metro map, like, you'd find clusters of disabled people around stations that actually have an elevator. I think it will be in sort of more understated ways. But like I said, I'm not naive enough to believe that it won't rear its ugly head. It does when everything else happens.
And how has COVID-19 impacted your community in Saskatchewan?
I think there's fear. I think that now we have sort of two major cities and then a few smaller cities. I mean, we're only a province of 1.2 million people or whatever we are. I think the same old logistical problems that show up are going to show up when the main health centers are in those two cities. So I think it's a lot of fear. I think there's going to be a lot of strain on the system, just like the government system, just like there is on every other system. I think that a lot of the issues that are affecting, should we say, non-disabled groups are also going to affect us, perhaps disproportionately, you know. So there's a ban on evictions, but that monetary pressure of deferred payments, both for our rent and for utilities like SaskPower, our Crown Corps, even at best, are only deferring payments, not forgiving them. I think whenever a disabled person is put at the mercy of their landlord, that's precarious. I think there's going to be a strain. I can't speak to this too much because I don't access that system, but I imagine there's going to be issues with the home care system, you know, the health care that goes out to people's houses to help them. I would argue that those workers are already underpaid and taking on a hell of a lot of risk. I think you're going to see more strain on that system. I doubt that sort of the equipment programs are going to be running for the foreseeable future. I would argue sort of three main providers of things like catheters and gloves and you know, cleaning solutions and whatever, you know, sort of disability medical supplies, right? Those are suddenly going to be, they're basically going to a phone-only system. I know the medical, sort of the more, you know, catheters and stuff are still going out. I think there's going to be a strain on that because we don't have as much of a network of sellers and things for that. You know, as it is, we only really have two companies that sell wheelchairs in the province, other than the free equipment things that happen. And so waiting lists and changes, and I get house calls when I need certain fixes that I can't do myself. I imagine those have stopped. All of these things kind of pile up, this sort of like little tricks of the trade that disabled people use to save spoons and money are going to float away.
And how can non-disabled people be allies to disabled people during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Shut the f*** and listen. Humility is not exactly a trait that I would attribute with able-bodied society on the whole, and people need to listen. They're about to be affected or are being affected by issues that disabled people have known for our entire history as a community, and they're about to hit them in the face. And what's not being talked about right now is how many people are going to become, the early studies of lung function for COVID-19 survivors of severe cases is significantly impaired. A lot of medical model terminology for me today. But I would not be surprised to see, a large influx of people who are going to see themselves inside of the disabled community with the breathing difficulties and whatever else can happen when you enter into a hospital under even the best care. And that means that able-bodied people need to listen to the needs of our community, because right now they're the needs of everybody. I hope that continues. I'm a little bit too much of a pessimist to believe that we're not going to go back to the ableist status quo, because the ableist status quo, like you said, with the eugenics approach in Alabama, because that's exactly what it is. As you said, that's already affecting care and affecting how people are viewed. I mean, the part of the reason I wanted to write that story, and I'm thankful that CBC let me, is that pretty tired of watching the quotes be, well, or the perception that this only affects the elderly and the disabled. Well, no, we're seeing sort of 28-year-old nurses pass away as a result of this virus. So we need to rethink what we think a healthy body is, and we need to rethink how we support those who aren't the run-of-the-mill able-bodied version that tends to become the media norm.
Are there any projects or any way to access your work that you would like our listeners to know about?
I think, given that you're at McGill, there's a page that CUP, the Canadian University Press, put up with the coverage from the different student newspapers about what campuses are doing for COVID-19. I know that Montreal just basically shut down, but what each of the provinces are doing, my writing can be read. The CBC article that you saw, I also had a piece about student labor reporting for a wonderful national magazine that happens to print locally here, Briar Patch Magazine. I'm easily findable on Twitter under my name, and happy to respond to any questions, writing opportunities.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche. You are just listening to an interview with John Lepke. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Again, that's at AvalancheCKUT on Twitter. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanche@ckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Thursday. That's up next.
to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's just after 6 p.m. on September 21st. I'm your host for today, Robin Fadden. I'm going to play a couple of different interviews on today's show, including an interview with a professor of political science and women's studies about capitalism's relationship with the natural world. So in light of that, and in anticipation of voting in the upcoming provincial election, I've been thinking about each party's stance on climate and environment. It's actually kind of difficult to find a clear answer, and other issues seem to be taking precedence over the climate crisis, despite its immediacy and its connection to basically everything in our lives, from our healthcare and education systems to employment and taxes. So I'm going to read a letter recently written as an op-ed by Montreal Community Action Groups For Our Kids Montreal, Pour Nos Enfants Montréal, and Mère au Front. And I'm a member of For Our Kids Montreal, and we've been working on ways to bring further attention to the climate crisis with the aim of finding solutions to it. I'm reading this letter to show that the environmental concerns of parents and their kids should matter to politicians and to all members of our communities here in Quebec. So the letter is called Climate Change, Parents of Quebec Are Voting for Their Kids' Future, written by Jennifer Smith of For Our Kids Montreal and Natalie Ainslie of Mère au Front on behalf of more than 185 signatories. Across Quebec, the parents of For Our Kids and Mère au Front are mobilizing to ensure that a livable planet is at the core of Quebec's upcoming election campaign and all future government decisions. To avoid climate catastrophe and the interconnected damage to our health and ecosystems, we demand that the next Quebec government filter all decisions through a climate lens for their impact on the environment, as happens in the UK and other countries. This is critical to ensure a future.